Audible Studios presents The Education of a Value Investor, My Transformative Quest for Wealth, Wisdom, and Enlightenment. Written by Guy Speer. Narrated by Malk Williams. Introduction. My goal in writing this book is to share some of what I've learned on my path as an investor. It's about the education of this investor, not any other investor. This story is not an investment how-to. It's not a roadmap. Rather, it's the story of my journey and of what I've learned along the way, with my own flaws and foibles and idiosyncratic abilities, and despite my considerable blind spots. Over the years, I've stumbled across some profound insights and powerful tools that I'd like to share with you. In most cases, these are not things that are written about in textbooks. Because it's a story about how things happen in the real world, and because the real world is messy, the topics are broad in scope. They range from the most insignificant of habits I've developed, like what to read first, to the grandest, whom to choose as heroes and mentors, and how their wisdom can change your life. This book traces the arc of a transformation. I started off as a Gordon Gekko wannabe, brash, short-sighted, and entirely out for myself. Then a series of transformations and self-realizations led me on a path from Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor to Ruane Cunniff to Poor Charlie's Almanac to Robert Cialdini, then to meeting Monish Pabrai and lunch with Warren Buffett. That $650,100 meal had a life-changing impact on me, as you will see. Within 1 year of my meeting with Buffett, I let two-thirds of my staff in New York go, stashed half of my family's belongings in storage, and shipped the other half to Zurich, where we went to live. I stopped charging management fees to new investors in my funds, I switched off my Bloomberg monitor, and I renounced my perilous addiction to checking stock prices on a minute-by-minute basis. I'm not necessarily advocating that you should also have lunch with Warren Buffett, especially now that the price tag has soared, hitting a high of $3.46 million in 2012. And I'm not claiming to have a special understanding of him either. What I can tell you is that he has had an extraordinary impact on how I invest and on the way I live my life. My hope is that I can share some of these lessons that I've derived from him so that they will benefit you as much as they have benefited me. It took me the best part of 2 decades to get onto a more enlightened path in life, and I've made many missteps and lost much time along the way. Hopefully this book will help you to reach your enlightened path faster and with fewer missteps. As Buffett once said, try to learn from your mistakes. Better yet, learn from the mistakes of others. I submit to you that if you learn only some of the lessons here, you cannot help but become rich, and perhaps wildly rich. Certainly the wisdom I've gleaned, not just from my heroes, but from my own mistakes and successes, has helped me immeasurably as an investor. As I write this, I've had a cumulative return of 463% since founding the Aquamarine Fund in 1997, versus 167% for the S&P 500 index. In other words, $1 million invested in the fund would now be worth $5.63 million versus $2.7 million if it had been invested in the S&P 500. But this book is also about the inner game of investing, and by extension, the inner game of life. As I've come to discover, investing is about much more than money. So as your wealth grows, I hope you will also come to realize that the money is largely irrelevant, and what you will want to do with the bulk of your wealth is give it back to society. You're not quite sure about that last part? That's okay. For much of my life, I wasn't sure about it myself, and a part of me still doubts it. Like you, I'm a work in progress. We're told a lot these days about why capitalism has failed us. We are told that greedy bankers and irresponsible CEOs need to be reined in with more stringent regulations, and that wealth should be more aggressively redistributed. Perhaps. But greed can also be a vehicle to something deeper and more soulful. In my experience, you can start out as a hungry young capitalist, driven almost entirely by greed, and find that it gradually leads you to a more enlightened mindset. In that case, greed may be good after all. Not if it merely motivates you to acquire more, but if it drives you toward that inner journey of spiritual growth and enlightenment. I expand on that lesson at the very end, but first, let's enter the belly of the beast. Chapter 1. From the Belly of the Beast to Warren Buffett. Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie, aunt. Ah, fie. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 2, lines 129 to 130 and 133 to 137. Have you ever felt that way? Utter self-loathing. Unlike Hamlet, at least I wasn't suicidal, but I felt almost as wretched. I was disgusted with investment bankers as a breed, and especially the ones I worked with. I felt the same way about my investment banking firm. Worst of all, though, I was disgusted with myself. Less than 2 years earlier, I had felt ready to conquer the world. Back then, I was a student at Harvard Business School, HBS. For good measure, I also had a degree from Oxford University, where I'd come top of my class in economics. Everything had seemed possible, until I threw it all away with one recklessly foolish career move. In 1993, a few months before I graduated from Harvard, I stumbled upon a job listing for an assistant to the chairman at D.H. Blair Investment Banking Corp. I'd read a bit about investment banking and fancied myself as one of those budding masters of the universe. Brimming with youthful confidence, I headed to New York City to meet with D.H. Blair's chairman, J. Morton Davis. Morty had started out as a poor Jewish kid from Brooklyn. He graduated from Harvard Business School in 1959 and went on to become the owner and chairman of D.H. Blair, which had been founded in 1904. People told me that he'd made hundreds of millions for himself. I met with him in his wood-paneled corner office at 44 Wall Street. The place hadn't been renovated in years, and it looked like a traditional investment banking partnership from John Pierpont Morgan's era. In fact, J.P. Morgan's headquarters were almost next door. Morty was a consummate salesman, and he did a brilliant job of beguiling me. He talked to me about some of the great deals he'd pulled off in hot areas like biotech, adding, "You'll be doing deals right away, working directly with me." He assured me that there was no limit to what I could achieve there with him, and later gave me a book by Frank Betker called How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success in Selling. I liked the fact that Morty was an outsider, unconventional, self-made, and highly successful. Shortly afterward, I read a New York Times article that referred to D.H. Blair as an infamous brokerage house, whose brokers have been known to refuse to let customers sell when they request that a stock be liquidated. The article also mentioned that securities regulators in Delaware had tried to revoke Blair's license, and that regulators in Hawaii said Blair was using fraudulent and deceptive sales practices. When I went back to ask him about the article, Morty told me that people envy success and try to take you down. I was gullible enough to believe whatever he told me. Some of my friends from Harvard raised their eyebrows when they heard that I was going to work for D.H. Blair, but I ignored their warnings. I was arrogant and slightly rebellious, and I was determined not to follow the standard route to establishment firms like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. I wanted to blaze my own trail and be more entrepreneurial. It felt as if Morty had made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, although I should have. So I signed on, thinking that I was golden, expecting Wall Street to show me the money. High on hope, I joined D.H. Blair in September 1993 with the grand title of Vice President. I shared a dimly lit wood-paneled room on the second floor with a kind elderly banker. He hadn't done a deal in years, but he was part of the scenery, burnishing the investment bank's sheen of respectability. Only 6 months into the job, I was miserable. I had received and continued to receive a series of hard knocks. For a start, I had thought that I'd be the chairman's sole assistant and that I'd have the opportunity to observe and learn from the master by helping him analyze the multitude of opportunities coming his way. Instead, it turned out that he had two other assistants. All three of us had shiny new MBAs. Len had gone to Harvard Business School. Drew was from Wharton. This was a dog-eat-dog environment, and the three of us were not a team. As I soon realized, there was absolutely no need for me on the analysis front. I was learning the hard way about what is normal on Wall Street. There are always more people available, and they are abundantly capable of doing the job that needs to be done. The competition is intense, and there are dozens of people lined up right behind you, ready to take your place. The only way I could add any value in this environment, and what the firm really needed me to do, was to bring in deals. I thought that I was up to the challenge. After all, it was a big selling point of the job. But the competition was fierce, both inside and outside the firm, and I was new. New to D.H. Blair, new to investment banking and finance, and new to New York. I was determined not to quit, though. That would have been an admission of defeat. I would have been mortified to let my classmates know that I'd made a mistake. Even worse, I would have been called a quitter, and that reputation might have followed me. More than anything, what motivated me was how other people viewed me rather than how I viewed myself. If this had been reversed, I don't think I would have stuck around that place for a minute. I would have simply ditched, but I was desperate to look successful. My singular goal became to get a deal done. That way I could declare victory and then choose to leave. So I smiled and dialed and pounded the pavement for many months, following up on every deal lead I possibly could, but I still came up empty-handed. Despite my massive testosterone-fueled determination to succeed in this, my first job after graduating with an MBA, I was hopelessly flailing. My problem wasn't just that the best deals got nabbed by the big names like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, although that was true. There were plenty of other opportunities around, but successfully bringing those deals into D.H. Blair required me to do things with facts that I had never done. D.H. Blair's specialty was venture capital and banking. It was one of the things that had attracted me to the firm. The opportunity to be on the cutting edge, funding startups with new technologies that would change the world. Oh, and did I mention that I would also get filthy rich in the process? In addition to my arrogance and hubris, I also had my fair share of Wall Street greed. I was convinced that I was on the quick path to nirvana. The harsh reality was that companies with technologies or innovations that really worked and were certain to succeed were extremely rare, even among the crowd that got its funding from more prominent investment banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Instead, the vast majority fell into the category of might succeed. There were a great many management teams that desperately wanted to pursue their dreams and that were willing to do and say pretty much anything if it meant getting funding. Before I knew it, I was drowning in a sea of crappy deals, assailed by entrepreneurs who hoped that I would look kindly upon them. The inexorable logic of expected probability that I had first learned about in high school and then studied at Harvard in a course called Decision Theory was that if I was going to recommend a deal, it had to have at least a fair chance of making money. Given how many deals failed, and the very small number that made investors a multiple of their original investment, my rough calculation was that the probability of success had to be at least 50% for the thing to get funded. But after a while, I came to believe that D.H. Blair's standards were far lower. On one memorable occasion, I was called into a meeting between the bank and an outfit looking to raise money for a cold fusion venture. Having studied the materials and read up a little on the background, I blurted out, "But the science just doesn't make sense." Implicitly, what I meant was, "Do you really expect me to keep a straight face and tell our salespeople that this crap is going to fly?" In another example, our firm IPO'd a company that was going to build a new space station in conjunction with the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Based on contracts with companies and entities formed by ex-government officials of this former Soviet republic. The company's only assets seemed to be sketchy contracts written in a foreign language that were unlikely to be enforceable in a Kazakh court, let alone in New York or London. Like the cold fusion nonsense, the probability that this thing would take flight was pretty low. But this was the business of D.H. Blair. Find some of the more extraordinary outlier opportunities, then hawk them to a naive and hopeful investing public that knew no better. To be fair, though many of these opportunities turned out to be duds and eventually failed, the firm also scored a big hit every now and then. For example, it had taken public one of the first biotech companies, Enzo Biochem, at a time when it was unthinkable to do an IPO for a company without earnings. And from time to time, D.H. Blair even IPO'd businesses that generated real and growing earnings. But in between the good deals, the firm needed fodder to feed the money-making machine. On the deal side, in addition to cash investment banking fees, D.H. Blair would take a healthy chunk of warrants in the companies that it financed. And on the investment side, D.H. Blair was often the only market maker in the shares that it took public. With bid-ask spreads as high as 20%, there were fat profits to be made just buying and selling the companies that went public. Like so many institutions on Wall Street, D.H. Blair had a nice edge on its clients. But generating trading volume in the stocks and getting a broader group of people interested in them required a lot of stage management. Dressing up an opportunity with questionable odds of success and turning it into something that the public was enthusiastic about buying was part of the role of D.H. Blair's analysts and investment bankers. To make one of these deals succeed and to grease the wheels of finance, various people needed to play their part. The Cold Fusion and Cosmodrome deals were not going to earn any money soon, if ever, but they did have sizzle. These companies represented ideas that could capture the public's imagination. If an enthusiastic investing public ended up developing a mania for cold fusion or space stations, this could easily propel the newly IPO'd stock into the stratosphere, to many multiples of its IPO price. From an investment banking standpoint, this sort of price action would make the deal a runaway success, even if the company eventually failed. As the stock rose, the bank would cash in on the warrants and make a profit trading the shares. If the company ultimately went bust, the shares would be broadly held, and it would not be D.H. Blair or its clients that bore the brunt of the loss. To get these sorts of situations going required aggressive salesmanship of every kind, so D.H. Blair had a retail brokerage unit filled with hard-charging brokers who called clients from a boiler room on the 14th floor. They were physically and legally separated from the investment bankers like me, and they officially worked for another company. While they were part of D.H. Blair & Co., I was employed by D.H. Blair Investment Banking Corp. Our tiny team of bankers constituted the acceptable, respectable face of the company, while the brokers were the backroom boys, touting these dubious deals to unsophisticated retail investors. They were chillingly reminiscent of the brokers in Martin Scorsese's movie The Wolf of Wall Street, which was exaggerated but not misleading. The 14th floor of D.H. Blair was a swirling sea of testosterone. Someone once told me that hookers would sometimes go up there to reward the most successful salesman of the day. I had no direct dealings with these guys, but they depended on our investment banking team to come up with deals for them to tout. The bankers could live with themselves because they were holed up in the handsome, wood-paneled cocoon of the second floor, while the really eye-opening activities went on 12 floors above. Still, the brokers needed us bankers as enablers. It was only after a year or so at D.H. Blair that it really started to dawn on me that this was a big part of the role I was expected to play. I was supposed to dress up the least sketchy of these deals in such a way that the downsides were heavily de-emphasized or ignored, while the sizzle, the blue sky upside, was highlighted. I wasn't there to act as a careful, well-trained analyst. They had no use for a forensic arbiter who painstakingly researched an idea, examined the opportunity, and pronounced as accurately and honestly as possible what this thing really was. In hindsight, I can see with clarity that the real value to the firm of my Oxford degree and my Harvard MBA was to adorn its deals and documents with my pristine credentials. I thereby provided a kind of Ivy League fig leaf. When I look back to our meeting with the Cold Fusion Company, I can see how naive I was. In truth, everyone there was expecting me to play my part. The elephant in the room was an unspoken dialogue that went something like this. Cold Fusion Company Management. Execs of D.H. Blair, Yes, we are bullshitting you. This is almost certainly not going to work, but we've been working on it for years and have invested substantial personal funds in it. In any case, nobody can prove 100% that it won't work. Moreover, think of the excitement that this thing will cause among investors and the press. It would be the only publicly traded nuclear fusion power company in the world. Other D.H. Blair investment bankers. Yes, this is extremely unlikely to fly, but we need to fill our pipeline of deals so that you, the company management, can get rich on the founder stock, and we, the investment bank, can get rich on fees and from trading the stock. And who knows, it might even succeed, in which case our clients might even make money too. In the midst of this cynical ritual, I was oblivious enough to mention that the physics was apparently bogus, remarking, "There are so many people out there who've claimed that they have made cold fusion work, and there's nothing new here." I was so tactless that I actually laughed out loud. Only in retrospect did I realize that I had instantly become the most hated person in that room. How could this deal ever fly if nitwits like me couldn't keep their big mouths shut? There was no way I was going to succeed in this environment with that kind of reckless honesty. But I didn't want to concede defeat, so I doubled down on my efforts, girding myself for more toil and trouble. I smiled some more and dialed some more, and I pounded many more pavements. Eventually, I found a deal with far better chances than most. This time, I could put my hand on my heart and say that, in spite of the risks, it deserved to get funding. The company was called Telechips, and in 1994, it had a communications device that was both a computer and a telephone. The management team was led by C.A. Al Burns, formerly at Bell Labs, and Randy Panato, a former salesman for one of the Baby Bells. The idea was solid, although well before its time. This was before the commercialization of the internet, and cell phones had only recently been introduced. I had also found an experienced investment banker, Howard Phillips, who was willing to work with me in structuring the deal and raising the funding. Phillips had a solid background at Oppenheimer and had come to D.H. Blair in semi-retirement. He worked in the office 2 or 3 days a week, and he had taken a mild liking to me. But having found a solid management team and convinced them that Phillips and I were their path to funding, I discovered a whole new realm of pain and unpleasantness. In spite of my understanding that Phillips and I were equal partners, I soon discovered that our fee split for doing the deal wasn't going to be 50-50 after all. He was taking the lion's share. I felt the hit to my pride more keenly than the one to my pocketbook. Still, if the deal was going to get done, I had no choice but to accept this. The next step was to get the deal approved. I imagined that given some of the dreck I'd seen in my short time there, this more plausible deal would just sail through. Phillips and I went through the investment committee and got a letter of intent stating the valuation and the amount we would raise for Telechips, subject to some cursory due diligence checks. I was ecstatic. So were Al and Randy, and we celebrated. They were elated that they could stop exhausting themselves in their pursuit of funding and could focus instead on building their business. Randy told me they had also been working on a highly credible alternative source of funding, but they were delighted to be working with me because they liked me. For my part, I was already pre-spending some of my smaller bonus and thinking of how I'd report this news to Class Notes, a Harvard alumni newsletter. Something along the lines of, "Guy Speer does his first deal within 18 months of leaving HBS. Howard Phillips, an old hand at this game, had not pre-spent any of his much larger portion of our expected bonus bonanza. He must have understood that the cursory due diligence checks were nothing of the sort. Our chairman, Morty Davis, had assigned this task to one of the other young investment bankers, who then proceeded to nitpick the deal to death. I couldn't believe it. He had been perfectly happy to cheerlead many other, much worse deals. Eventually, with Telechip's management wondering what the holdup was, and with me at a loss for answers, we were all summoned to another meeting. By now, the Telechip's team was desperate for funding as the company was burning through cash. I learned that because of the nitpicks, sorry, I mean serious due diligence, the deal could still get done, but at a far lower valuation than our original term sheet had promised, and with much heftier fees now payable to the investment bank. I got a call from Randy, telling me how appalled he was by the bank's behaviour and with me for stringing them along. All I could do was apologise and say that I honestly hadn't known that it would turn out this way. I hoped he believed me, but I'm still not sure he did. On a personal level, I'd certainly lost his trust, not to mention his friendship. A day or two later, Telechips accepted the term sheet, as everyone knew they would. They had been strung along until the investment committee was confident that the company would have no alternative. I was incensed and disgusted, not least with myself. Looking back, I now realized that I was potentially teetering on the edge of a moral cliff. If I had been drawn any further into this firm's culture, either willingly or unwillingly, I would have fallen irretrievably off that cliff. In fact, a few years after I left, D.H. Blair, having run afoul of the regulators, was reduced to a shadow of its former self. The retail brokerage business, D.H. Blair & Co., closed down entirely in 1998. In 2000, the Wall Street Journal reported that this retail brokerage unit and 15 of its officers and employees had been indicted on 173 counts of stock fraud. Among other things, the retail brokerage firm was charged with manipulating stock prices for its own benefit and engaging in illegal sales tactics. Four executives at the retail firm, Chairman Kenton Wood, Vice Chairman Alan Staller and Cal Renoff, and head trader Vito Capitorto, pleaded guilty to securities fraud and collusion to fix stock prices. USA Today reported that D.H. Blair & Co. and its executives paid $21 million to reimburse defrauded customers. The investment bank, which was a separate company, emerged unscathed, and no criminal charges were brought against its chairman, Morty Davis. But it must have been a terrible time for him, not least because Staller and Renoff were his sons-in-law. In the press, Morty himself took a beating. For example, a 1998 article in Forbes referred to the controversial figure of penny stock king J. Morton Davis, who got rich by raising money in the private and public markets for companies that Tonia firms wouldn't touch. When I left Harvard and went to work on deals with him, this wasn't quite what I had in mind. What's sad is that Morty truly wasn't a bad person. I remember going for a family dinner at his house one Friday evening and being touched by how kindly and warmly he included me. There was much to admire in him, and it's certainly not for me to judge anyone. Still, from what I had seen of the culture at D.H. Blair, its problems with regulators were hardly surprising. For my part, I don't know for sure how close I was to the edge of that moral cliff. But knowing what I know now, I can tell you that 1,000 miles away would have been too close. In retrospect, I had been dangerously blind about the motives and ethics of my colleagues. This was powerful proof of just how dumb even smart, well-educated people can be. It certainly took me far too long to grasp that this business was set up in such a way that, if I wanted to win, I would have to lose whatever was left of my moral compass. For months, I was focused on the wrong questions, wondering why I was having so much trouble getting deals done and fretting that something must be wrong with me. I didn't have the experience or the perspective to understand that this whole environment was wrong. Part of the problem was that the competition was so fierce. This led to the belief that if I wasn't willing to do something, someone else would quickly step in to do it. This kind of environment is perfectly designed to get people to push the boundaries in order to succeed. It's a pattern that's repeated again and again on Wall Street. Through ambition, greed, arrogance, or naivete, many bright, hard-working people have strayed into grey areas. Still, it's important to clarify one point. No member of D.H. Blair's management ever directly asked me to lie or misrepresent anything. Even though I believed that a big aspect of the place was about misrepresenting opportunities to a credulous marketplace. For example, they would have appreciated my claiming that I had done my due diligence on Cold Fusion and that it checked out. Bang! They would have had one piece of the ideal scenery they needed in order to close the deal. But they never said as much in so many words. The rules of the game were implicit. At D.H. Blair, I observed another pattern that plays itself out countless times on Wall Street. Everybody wants to make money. So the senior greedy bankers who should know better turn a blind eye while the younger greedy naive bankers push the boundaries. At Lehman Brothers, they pushed leverage. At Countrywide, they ignored default rates on subprime. At SAC Capital, they turned a blind eye to rampant insider trading. My experience at D.H. Blair has helped me see how often this sort of thing recurs in a wide variety of environments on Wall Street. During the tech bubble of the late 1990s, lousy companies were being talked up and sold to an unsuspecting public. For example, analysts like Henry Blodgett at Merrill Lynch were wildly bullish about internet stocks, dressing up pigs with lipstick. Years later, the same thing happened at credit rating agencies, where analysts issued blindly positive ratings for the CMOs and CDOs that would ultimately lead to the housing crisis. As for me, my 18 gut-wrenching months at D.H. Blair had destroyed my clean copybook and brought my career to an absolute low. The resume and reputation I had built for myself at Oxford and Harvard had been reduced to dust, and reputation in business, especially the investing world, is everything. For years after I left D.H. Blair, I felt so sullied by the experience that it was as if I couldn't wash the dirt off my hands. Even as I write about this now, my skin crawls. Part of me wonders if it's a mistake to write about it at all, but I think it's important to discuss just how easy it is for any of us to get caught up in things that might seem unthinkable, to get sucked into the wrong environment and make moral compromises that can tarnish us terribly. We like to think that we can change our environment, but the truth is that it changes us, so we have to be extraordinarily careful to choose the right environment, to work with and even socialize with the right people. Ideally, we should stick close to people who are better than us, so that we can become more like them. I hope the decision to work at D.H. Blair will turn out to be the worst mistake of my professional life, but thankfully it didn't break me. In an article entitled "Trauma Reveals the Roots of Resilience," the psychologist Diana Fosher quotes a line from Ernest Hemingway: "The world breaks everyone, and afterward some are strong at the broken places." Why is it that some people are strengthened by their traumas and not broken by them? It's a great question that can also be asked about business and investing. Warren Buffett made one of his bigger mistakes when, in his 30s, he invested in the loss-making Berkshire Hathaway textile mills. This could have been his undoing, but he later transformed Berkshire Hathaway into the towering monument of his life. He did so in part by learning to invest in better businesses instead of betting on the cigar butt stocks like Berkshire that Ben Graham had taught him to buy. Perhaps D.H. Blair was my own cigar butt move, a formative experience of toxic shock. It's not just a quaint self-help idea that the people who succeed are those who get up when life knocks them down. An essential component of our education is to learn from our mistakes, and if we don't make mistakes, sometimes we may not learn at all. Certainly the whole D.H. Blair debacle was an essential component of my education as a value investor. One of the biggest lessons was that I must never do anything again that could taint my reputation. As Buffett once warned, it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. If you think about that, you'll do things differently. Another lesson was that I had to do everything I could to change my professional and intellectual environment. When I discovered the world of Warren Buffett, it was as if I had found a lifeline. The discovery happened one summer day around the time that the Telechips deal came across my desk. By then, I was already deeply disillusioned with the life I was leading. I found myself no longer eating sandwiches at my desk on the second floor at D.H. Blair. I'd lost my desire to build this sort of career, but I had no idea what to do and was afraid to leave for fear of seeming like a loser or a quitter. Looking for an escape, I'd sneak out at lunchtime and buy a falafel or a shawarma from a street vendor. Then I'd wander into Zuccotti Park in the shadow of the World Trade Center and play a few games of pick-up chess. On the way back, I'd often duck into a business bookshop on Broadway just off Wall Street and browse the shelves. The first book I bought there was Frank Fabozzi's Bond Markets, Analysis and Strategies. I was engrossed by his technical discussions of asset-liability matching and the measurement of bond duration. For a while, I even imagined myself as a bond trader. On another visit to this store, I picked up Ben Graham's seminal book, The Intelligent Investor, featuring a preface by Buffett. I could not put it down. Graham spoke eloquently of owning a stock not as a piece of paper to trade, but as a share in a real business. He also talked of treating Mr. Market like a manic depressive and taking advantage of his shifting moods. As the market veers between fear and greed, investors can profit richly by focusing in a clear-headed way on the intrinsic value of a company and exploiting the discrepancy between the price and the value. Sometimes you know in your bones that something is true. To me, this value investing philosophy made so much sense that it was self-evident. Before long, I also read Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist, a brilliant biography by Roger Lowenstein. I was captivated by the deals of Buffett's life. There could not have been a more flagrant contrast between the way he lived and the way I was living, and there could not have been a starker contrast between my deal-making experiences at D.H. Blair and his own business ethos. Buffett wasn't working in a snake pit. He wasn't finding pretexts to sell dubious dreck to hard-working folks on Main Street or hustling for a fatter share of brokerage fees and then stabbing his peers in the back. I had no clue yet how to implement any of this in my own life, but I felt a deep and desperate need to get out of where I was and move closer to where he was. It was as if he were holding out his hand to me so that I could drag myself out of the moral quagmire in which I was sinking. I clung to him for dear life. This book is about my journey from that dark place toward the nirvana where I now live. Chapter 2. The Perils of an Elite Education. In order to move forward, I had to fix what was broken. I had to figure out what was wrong with my wiring so I could rewire myself. So I began to ask myself why I'd gone to D.H. Blair in the first place. What possessed a purportedly smart person to do something so spectacularly foolish? After all, there were many other options open to me. This exploration was the beginning of my inward journey, and one of the things I came to realize was that my ivory tower education had left me dangerously exposed and vulnerable. My ending up at D.H. Blair was certainly a betrayal of the purposes of my education at Oxford and Harvard. I'd attended two of the world's finest institutions only to become an inadvertent accomplice in a perversion of the finance industry. Did my education fail me? Or even worse, did I fail my education? There's a larger question to be asked here too, since I'm also a microcosm of my peer group. Why did so many highly educated people from elite business schools and privileged backgrounds contribute to and exacerbate the financial crisis of 2008 to 2009? Did our education fail us, or did we fail our education? These questions haven't been answered adequately by the prestigious universities that groomed all these high-powered creators of economic mayhem. I have to ask these questions even if I'm not qualified to answer them, because what was going on in my life was, in many ways, just an extreme reflection of what was going on in the lives of my peers. So many of us went into finance with tremendous confidence in our intelligence and abilities, only to discover that the system we became part of was capable of causing more harm than good. The unsettling truth is that there are elements of an elite education that are positively a disadvantage. I wasn't aware of these disadvantages at the time that I finished my formal education, or for about a decade afterward. On some level, I had my eyes closed and was cruising on autopilot for quite a while, wasting what should have been some of the most productive years of my life. If you had an educational experience that was anything like mine, you, like me, may have to reprogram and rewire yourself in some fundamental ways. The person who has influenced me most as an investor is Monish Pabrai, an Indian immigrant to the United States who has racked up far better returns than I have. He studied at Clemson University in South Carolina, not at Oxford or Harvard, and when Monish and I had our charity lunch with Warren Buffett, you can be sure that Warren, who had failed to gain admission to Harvard Business School, couldn't have cared less where either of us had studied. Don't get me wrong. Places like Oxford and Harvard are wonderful, and I appreciate their immense contribution to our civilization. But in lionizing them, we can fail to discern their drawbacks. So if some of what I say about these universities sounds overly harsh, please understand that it's a harshness born of affection and a desire to build up rather than tear down. Part of the problem is that a finely trained but rarefied academic mind can be damaging to your long-term success. You can easily end up with the mental equivalent of a Formula One Ferrari, when what you need in the real world is a hardy Jeep that can operate adequately in a variety of environments. To explain this, let me first give you some background on the particularities of my own formal education. I came to Oxford from the City of London Freeman's School, an independent high school originally founded for the benefit of orphans. Gullible parents imagined that it was a fancy English private school, but it was really a less exalted crammer. Many of the educational decisions there were made on the basis of what would get the most students into the best universities. Some of the teachers were remarkable, but for the most part, the goal wasn't to educate us in a broad sense. Instead, it was merely to analyze what it would take for us to perform well in our A-level and university entrance exams. The system then screened and drilled us so we could get the highest scores. My Oxford entrance papers consisted of math, physics, and a general paper. And guess what? The system worked. I'd been so well trained that despite disastrously misreading the instructions on one exam, I was accepted at Brasenose College, Oxford, to study law. But now I was alongside students who had been more broadly educated and who knew stuff that I did not. Although I loved jurisprudence or legal philosophy, the curriculum also required me to wade through dozens of British common law cases each week. Now, British common law is a phenomenal subject, but not for an 18-year-old whose family had immigrated to the United Kingdom 7 years earlier and who had little social or historical knowledge of the country. I started to have recurring dreams in which I could press a special button that would incinerate every tome of common law on the planet. I believe that it's never good to ignore your recurring dreams for long. Contrast this experience with that of a friend at Brasenose, Andrew Feldman, now Lord Andrew Feldman, chairman of Britain's Conservative Party. He'd studied copious amounts of British and world history and was able to set the law within its current and historical social context. For Andrew, the law was a fascinating microcosm of everything he had already studied. For me, it was a morass of intractable case law. I had been prepared to pass exams, but I didn't have the benefit of his broader framework. There's an important lesson here. It's not enough to be in a great program at a great school. You need to be in a program that matches your particular needs at that stage in your life. Back then, studying law was wrong for me. It was in this state of dissatisfaction that I noticed Peter Sinclair, a Brasenose economics professor, every time we walked past each other in one of the college quads. He always had such a kind smile for me, as he did for all of the students. Anybody who met him could feel that he was this incredibly benevolent soul. One day, at the end of my second year, I woke up with the realization that there was absolutely no way I could study law for another day. It felt as if an inexorable force had welled up in me until this wasn't even a debate. These moments of clarity are so rare in life, and even the people closest to us may question whether we should act on such instincts. I believe it's crucial to pay attention to these non-rational convictions that percolate inside us, even if we can't explain them. My academic training, with its emphasis on hyper-rational analysis, would deny the value of these almost inexplicable instincts and yearnings, but we need to respect these deeper recesses of our minds. This is not dissimilar to the way George Soros learned to tune into his acute back pain as a signal that there was something wrong in his portfolio. Who is to say where the mind ends and the body begins? I felt a similar sense of clarity and certainty when I decided to marry my wife, Laurie. I knew with all my body and soul that we should be together. I had the same absolute clarity when I discovered value investing. I didn't think this was the right path for me. I simply knew it. I'm convinced that Warren Buffett makes his investment decisions the same way, performing an extraordinarily complex set of analyses almost unconsciously. Every one of us has a handful of moments like this in the course of a lifetime, but we need the courage to act on them. In any case, I walked into Peter Sinclair's office and asked if I could study economics as part of the PPE, Politics, Philosophy and Economics curriculum. To this day, I have no idea what possessed him to say yes and help me make the change, but I feel endless gratitude toward him because that single act may have done more to transform my life than anything else. The minute I became a PPE student, I started to feel connected to the world. Instead of reading up on turgid case law, my workload now felt like an in-depth exploration of what lay behind the day's headlines. It was a powerful example of what happens when we heed Joseph Campbell's injunction to follow our bliss. New paths open up, and we feel joy at being alive. But before long, I was floundering again. Even though I enjoyed the subject tremendously, I faced a major disadvantage. 2 years into my university career, I hadn't studied politics, philosophy, or economics for a single day, and I had no idea what I was doing. Within months, the academic authorities informed me that if I didn't improve my performance, I might be expelled for academic reasons. The chilling Oxford term was to be sent down. Feeling hopelessly ignorant, I would stay up for most of the night trying to cobble together a half-decent essay. I knew how far behind the other students I was. One of them was the future British Prime Minister, David Cameron, who was highly intelligent and articulate and superbly prepared by his years at Eton. We'd sit together in an economics tutorial with three or four other students, and I felt intimidated to speak in front of him because he was so much better informed than I was about British history and politics. Even the professors were impressed with him, whereas I had little clue about anything. Students would sometimes banter about Cameron's erudite performances in his political tutorials with Vernon Bogdanor, a renowned constitutional scholar who is now an advisor to both the Queen and the Prime Minister. Apparently, Cameron and Bogdanor would launch into debates over which of the Victorian Prime Ministers, Disraeli or Gladstone, was a more effective leader. Hearing these tales, I felt woefully inadequate since I had scant knowledge of British history and barely understood the basics of the political system. My way of competing was to focus ferociously on topics where I could stand out. I fell in love with political philosophy and spent countless hours debating and pontificating about John Rawls' theory of justice and other esoteric subjects. Fueled by fear of being sent down and exposed as stupid and undeserving of my place at Oxford, I learned to dazzle intellectually as a way of concealing my insecurities. I had a burning desire to be accepted and respected within this group of exceptionally smart people. This was fun when I was doing well and winning, but not so much fun otherwise. I was driven in large part by what Warren Buffett calls the outer scorecard, that need for public approval and recognition which can so easily lead us in the wrong direction. This is a dangerous weakness for an investor, since the crowd is governed by irrational fear and greed rather than by calm analysis. I would argue that this kind of privileged academic environment is largely designed to measure people by an external scorecard. Winning other people's approval was what really counted. So during those formative years, I was developing a serious flaw that I would later need to identify and reverse. Value investors have to be able to go their own way. The entire pursuit of value investing requires you to see where the crowd is wrong so that you can profit from their misperceptions. This requires a shift toward measuring yourself by an inner scorecard. To become a good investor, I would need to come to an acceptance of myself as an outsider. The real goal, perhaps, is not acceptance by others, but acceptance of oneself. Of course, I didn't realize this back then, so I focused on mastering the rules of that exclusive academic world. I learned to think on my feet and come back with quick, sharply worded answers that would require my peers and professors to pay attention to me. To some extent, I still operate this way. When I get stressed or feel insecure, I revert to the dazzle them intellectually mode that I learned at Oxford. Only later would I see that this hard-earned skill was only really useful within the narrow confines of a university and a few other intellectually elitist environments. Someone like Monish doesn't have all these dazzling skills, but he's way smarter than I am and educated himself in ways that are far more practical and effective in the real world. And here's the rub. What was the point of having studied and appreciated the deep elegance of Rawls' theory of justice if I was so obtuse that I couldn't see that D.H. Blair was a snake pit? Even once I finally realized that I'd dug myself into this hole, it took me several unnecessary months before I galvanized myself to climb out. How is it possible that I could be so well educated and yet not have the common sense or moral courage to get out of D.H. Blair instantly? Our top universities mold all these brilliant minds, but these people, including me, still make foolish and often immoral choices. This also goes for my countless peers who, despite their elite training, fail to walk away from nefarious situations in other investment banks, brokerages, credit rating agencies, bond insurance companies, and mortgage lenders. For university educators, a little soul-searching would also not be remiss. My study of economics at Oxford did at least develop my technical skills and my ability to reason. I eventually learned to analyze and tease out the implications of various economic policies. Some of this technical knowledge is not only intellectually elegant, but is also of inestimable practical importance to anyone who wants to understand what policies drive economic success. But there are also economic theories that, for all their elegance, turn out not to be useful at all in the real world. I didn't have the ability to evaluate them critically, and this academic environment wouldn't have rewarded such heresy, so I swallowed everything wholesale without question. The most important example of this is the efficient markets hypothesis, which is a powerful and theoretically useful assumption about how the world works. This hypothesis holds that financial prices reflect all of the information available to participants in the market. That has profound implications for investors. If it were true, there would be no bargains in the stock market, since any price anomalies would be instantly arbitraged away. In the real world, this is simply not true, but it took me a decade to realize it. Some aspects of my economics curriculum were so valuable that I somehow assumed that it was all equally valid. Part of the problem was that I had sharpened my ability to appeal to the academicians who graded my papers instead of training my mind to solve real-world problems. My professors neglected to ask seriously whether the efficient markets hypothesis reflected reality, so I could safely neglect this question too. I clung to this wrong-headed assumption with such unquestioning certainty that when I first encountered Warren Buffett at Harvard Business School a few years later, I had no interest in him at all. After all, if the market were efficient, the whole endeavor of searching for undervalued stocks would be futile. In my pursuit of academic success, I had narrowed my mind to such a degree that I was incapable of perceiving what was in front of me. In this again, I'm a symptom of a broader problem. The very institutions that we have established to teach us to think independently often close our minds in potentially damaging ways. Charlie Munger discussed this very problem in a classic talk he gave at Harvard Law School in 1995 on the 24 standard causes of human misjudgment. He described how B.F. Skinner influenced an entire generation of psychologists to espouse behaviorism in spite of plenty of disconfirming evidence. As the joke goes, science advances one funeral at a time, as eminent but wrong-headed scientists bite the dust. At Oxford, it didn't matter that I was misguided in equally fundamental ways. Despite my real-world ignorance, I graduated first in my class in economics. If you stop and think about it, that should be a cause of some concern. Nonetheless, my self-confidence and my arrogance soared. With my shiny new credentials, I scored a plum job at a strategy consulting firm called Braxton Associates. The senior management had all attended Harvard Business School, so I applied a couple of years later and was accepted. At HBS, the curriculum is devoted exclusively to studying real business case studies, rather than focus on theories of how the world should work. We focused on practical discussions of what had actually happened. This approach to educating leaders is far more robust and practical than the Oxford model, as each case study provides a new set of facts and circumstances to analyze, creating a useful reservoir of experience. But Harvard also accentuated my hubris. To use an Indian phrase that I love, I was a topper, and my glossy academic credentials reinforced my feeling that the world owed me a living in return for my general awesomeness. In my first semester at Harvard, Warren Buffett came to speak at the business school. In my ignorance and arrogance, I instantly dismissed him as some speculator who had just gotten lucky. After all, the theoretical models I'd learned at Oxford made it a self-evident truth that searching for undervalued stocks was pointless, given that markets were efficient. For me to grasp that he'd made a fortune precisely by exploiting market inefficiencies would have required me to ditch all of my painfully acquired academic models, and so I did what many people do when the facts disagree with their theories. I dismissed the facts and clung to the theory. What I might well have said to him at the time was, "Mr. Buffett, don't confuse me with the facts because I already have my firm opinions about efficient markets." But if the truth be told, I was only in the lecture room at all because I was chasing after a woman in the second year who'd upset me by going out the previous night with another classmate. I didn't even sit down during Buffett's lecture, and I can't remember a single word he said. It's a tragicomic reminder that my fragile ego mattered far more to me than the opportunity to learn. By contrast, part of what makes Warren himself so successful is that he's never stopped seeking to improve himself, and that he continues to be a learning machine. As Munger has said, Warren is better in his 70s and 80s in many ways than he was when he